This webcast is made possible in part by support from the listener members of the Classical Network, WWFM and WWFM.org. Thank you for your support. Cadenza, winner of the Deems Taylor Virgil Thompson Award for Broadcasting, is a production of the Classical Network. Funding for this program is made possible by the listener members of the Classical Network. I'm David Ozenberg, your host. This week is the third in our four-week series where we're chatting with some of the most talented, impactful, and original pianists on the scene today. We'll chat with the Russian-born, now American pianist, Kirill Gerstein. Growing up in a heavy industrial town southeast of Moscow, his talent was spotted early on, and he was channeled into the special education circles. But his passion at home was jazz. Through the amazing circumstances of having a major American jazz artist hear him play at a competition and then giving him the chance to come and study music here in the U.S., he then had a decision on whether to perform and focus on jazz or classical. Classical won out, and his career has not been only steadily growing, but as the New York Times has written, he is emerging as one of the most respected pianists of his generation. He has won competitions and awards, and after winning the Gilmour Artist Award, he is using those winnings to expand the repertoire for his instrument through an ambitious commissioning project. He will be in New York this weekend with the New York Philharmonic performing perhaps the greatest standard warhorse concerto for his instrument, Tchaikovsky's Piano Concerto No. 1. I'll give details at the end of our chat, but it's with a twist, as he has, through the graces of the Tchaikovsky Museum and Archive in Russia, the original version of that concerto in the way Tchaikovsky knew it and conducted it, with a vast different temperament to the opening. You'll hear that at the close of this program. His latest CD is one of the peaks to tackle for any pianist, the 12 Transcendental Etudes of Franz Liszt. You heard the opening Preludio, and now you're hearing the next movement, the Molto Vivace. I spoke with Kirill Gerstein a few weeks back. I'm very happy to be speaking with pianist Kirill Gerstein. Usually when I talk with people, I'll dig into some artistic background on you before I go into your latest recording and kind of save that. But I'll jump in right here. Congrats on the new disc with the Liszt. I wonder if you could talk a little about this piece. The piece garners a lot of praise. There are a number of recordings of it, but it probably doesn't show up in recitals as often as it should, or at least some of the movements. 12 pieces, Liszt Plan 24. It stems all the way back from when he was a youngin. Into his middle age, tinkering with it. But it is an important piece of not only for Liszt, but of 19th century pianism. Could you talk just a little bit about the importance of this piece historically and musically?
Yeah, with great pleasure. I mean, I think Liszt is absolutely central to us as a really the father of all piano playing that has come since after him. So he is the father of modern piano playing. And it's interesting to think that modern piano playing was thus invented somewhere between 1830 and 1850 or 55. So we're talking exactly those two decades when Liszt is busy with this great cycle, the Transcendental Etudes. He wrote three versions of this, of the cycle, and they kind of represent the young Liszt, the incredibly dashing, over-virtuosic young man And then finally, the mature list and the third version of this cycle is what I recorded. And it's a bit like the, you know, the Everest of piano playing of the repertoire for us. It's certainly a cycle of 12 incredibly virtuosic pieces. And so you could say, so technically virtuosic, there's thousands of notes of every kind. But of course, it goes much beyond the mere physical virtuosity. And there are many kinds of virtuosities to be dealt with and to be brought out in the cycle. The art of tone painting on the piano, so to say, which kind of presages impressionism. And the experiment with the spooky, with the otherworldly, with the spiritual, which I think is also a part of why the cycle is called Transcendental Etudes. Liszt never quite told us what did he mean by this transcendental. And I think in this case, we as interpreters have to think about this element also as one to be interpreted. What did he mean by saying transcendental etudes? And so I think in addition to the staggering virtuosic demands that were at the time so near unprecedented, perhaps, you know, there were a couple people in the world that were playing these initially. And it's actually interesting to note that not until 1904 did the first performance of the complete cycle take place. This was with the great Italian pianist, in some way, an inheritor of the Liszt tradition. The great Italian pianist Ferruccio Busoni performed them first as a cycle in 1904. And as you said, yes, there are a number of these etudes that have become staples of concert programs as individual selections, but it is more rare to hear the cycle complete. And I do think there is a good argument for playing the complete cycle, because I don't think Liszt put the order of the pieces and the pieces themselves accidentally. I don't think it's an accidentally thrown together cycle. So the pieces definitely have a certain unfolding narrative arc. And it does start, if you look at the first and second etude, the first is a preludio, so-called. The pianist sort of tries out the piano, the hall, the sound. And then the second one is very so diabolically virtuosic in the style of Paganini caprices that so impressed Liszt and essentially pushed him to develop the piano technique in this extreme direction. So you could say that the first and second are still very physical and materially present etudes and transcendentally difficult, but very much of this world. And then if you look to the end of the cycle, when you have this chasse-neige, the winter storm, and to think that he chooses to finish the cycle with a piece that depicts this falling white snow that buries everything underneath, and finally the canvas of this piece and the canvas of the whole cycle is wiped out in complete whiteness. So obliteration by whiteness, you know. And if you think about that, that's a very modern way to finish a cycle. So it's very forward looking, and there are many very forward looking aspects in the individual pieces and in the cycle itself. So Liszt is not to be underestimated, and despite the fact that he's so incredibly famous, still, I think, as a composer of great importance for pianists, and not only, but generally for music and for the course of music history, I think there we still have some fighting to do for him to be placed in a way that's befitting to what a revolutionary, experimental musical mind that he was.
Once again, for my guest, Kiro Gerstein's new recording of Franz Liszt's Transcendental Etudes on the Mirios Classics label, this is the movement called Feu Follet, or Will o' the Wisp. one would hope, and I think through efforts of pianists like you and others, that this cycle, these 12, even though, you know, he wanted 24, let's take the 12, would start appearing as an evening's worth of pianism. I'm thinking of how many performances now, just in the last 20 years, there are of, let's say, the Goldberg Variations and things like that, that this would take its place, because it really does deserve it, like you said. It really needs to be heard in its entirety of how Liszt, after the revisions, laid this out. It's an incredible piece.
I agree with you. I think it's partly, it is that reputation of Liszt, which has been supported in some way by some interpretations where, you know, if you go for the absolute fastest and loudest, let's say in each of these etudes, even when it may look appropriate for the single piece taken as a standalone composition, but it can quickly grow very tiring as a, you know, part of a 1 hour cycle of pieces. So the interpretive decisions when playing it complete or when recording it complete, I believe, have to be somewhat different. We as performers have to make sure that the cycle is tasty and edible in its entirety, because if you just hear, you know, piles and piles of loud notes, this is a disservice to the cycle and also to Liszt, because then it proves exactly the stereotype. Oh, Liszt is so, you know, loud and virtuosic, but it's not so profound like, let's say, you know, the Goldberg Variations that you just named. But I think a lot of the fault is at the feet of the performances and not necessarily at the feet of the great composers that have written these pieces. So therein is one of the wonderful challenges of the life of an interpreter, that it's for us to find a way for the composer's idea to come through effectively. And it's, I think, better that the people think the piece was great and performance is less good, rather than, oh, it's a great performance, but the piece is not so good.
Now, I've heard it done as a cycle, and you're right. So much is on the performer's shoulders, but it can happen, and it should happen more often. One last dip into my guest's new recording of the Transcendental Etudes of Franz Liszt, this the concluding movement, no barn burner here, but the odd stroke of depicting whirling winds of snow, the Chasse-Neige, Kirill Gerstein performs. Thank you. We need to talk about your path to the piano a bit. It's not typical. You grew up in a, we could say a military industrial type of town about southeast, I believe, of Moscow. I think that's where it's at. You benefited from the educational system, a special school set up. But what you were practicing and playing at school was not the music that was going through your head at home. So maybe briefly tell our audience what those two worlds were for you.
Yes, well, you started hinting at this. I grew up and had the advantage, or took advantage, of this rather structured early music education system that Russia has had in place, with a special music school where, quite essentially from the beginning of the school education, it is planned, the curriculum is planned in such a way that, with the assumption that the children may become later professional musicians. And it's quite a good idea. There's a total mixing of the musical curriculum and regular subjects in one building, in one schedule, and a very thorough and deep music education. So in that way, that was quite a common background for a number of Russian musicians that started out as children. But yes, at the same time, at home, in addition to classical music, I heard quite a bit of jazz. My parents had a number of jazz LPs, and I was very attracted to that sound as well. And there I was also, I must say, I was lucky, because contrary to some experiences of my colleagues in a similar background, my teachers did not actively discourage me from also exploring jazz. So for quite a while, I did both classical and jazz music. Started out with jazz, so, you know, trying to imitate it by ear from the recordings. And it kind of went hand in hand. When I was 11, I went to a classical piano competition in Poland, which I ended up winning. And at the same time, while I was there, a musician overheard my practicing some jazz in one of the practice breaks and said, oh, actually, I'm connected to a jazz workshop that invites professors from Berklee College of Music in Boston, from the very famous jazz school. So one thing led to another. So after this competition, I got an invitation to play for the first time with orchestra when I was 12. And at the same time, I got an invitation to go to this jazz workshop in Poland. And that was my first exposure to, let's say, professional jazz musicians. And then furthermore, one thing led to another. And I got invited to come to Berklee in Boston for a summer music program. And once that was done, and that was a tremendous explosion of, you know, knowledge and information about jazz that I lacked while I was in Russia, because at the time it still was, you know, this is 93, 94. So it was rather hard to come by. And then they made this fantastic offer that I would get a full scholarship and could come to Boston to study jazz as a full-time college student at the age of 14. And that's what brought me to America. And then for the next 3 years, I continued to do classical and jazz. During that period, the classical side of my life took somewhat of a secondary role, and I did much more jazz. And then finally, when I was about 16, 17, I felt that I really had to make a decision, because the sitting on two chairs eventually is problematic. And I did come to this kind of acute feeling that one or the other can be practiced, 26 hours a day, and one can really live in either one fully and still feel like you don't have enough time. And so if I would try to continue doing both with equal sense of engagement, that then eventually one or the other suffers. So that's when I did choose to continue concentrating on classical music, because I felt that, especially as pianists, we have such a enormous library of great works. You know, we have just an enormous library of works. So in that, there is an enormous section of first-rate works and still an enormous section of second-rate compositions that are still excellent, and even third-rate that are still very good. So the library of piano music is essentially near endless. and to explore the thoughts of these great musical geniuses such as, you know, Bach and Beethoven and Liszt and Rachmaninoff and whoever else you want to pick is enormously interesting and fulfilling to me. And I thought that despite, you know, the trade-off of not necessarily having a regular joy of coming up with quote-unquote my own stuff, the joy of being able to touch with my fingers the great thoughts and feelings of these amazing composers, that would be, in the long run, the most fulfilling and interesting occupation for me. And so it has remained.
We should give him his props. People say, well, how did he win a piano competition in Poland and then meet some people and end up at Berklee? Of course, you met the great jazz vibes player, Gary Burton, and he sort of made it possible, which was an incredible break for you. It was very cool. But to make that decision when you're in Boston, going to Berklee, to have to choose between, you just articulated why you did it, and it must have been a difficult decision. Do you still keep your, what we would say, jazz chops up, and do you still, that's still a viable part of your artistry, even though you, the world knows you as a classical pianist?
Well, I think, you know, the experience, and it was a deep experience, has left its not only just trace, but, you know, there's a part of me that has lived that. And I think in imperceptible ways, you know, it contributes to my whole musical makeup of my personality. I don't keep it up actively. There are things that come up, some, you know, collaborative projects with some, also with some jazz musicians or jazz related repertoire. But I would compare it, it's a language that I spoke a lot as a child, and is not a, and an adolescent, and is not a language that I currently speak in actively. But at the same time, you know, it's not foreign to me. So, and sometimes, you know, I toy with the idea of so investing again more time in that and seeing what that would bring. So it's there in me. But of course, nowadays, I am fully immersed in a huge number of repertoire pieces that keeps me very busy, such as the Transcendental Etudes of Liszt.
From one of my guests, Kirill Gerstein's first recordings on the global market on the Munich-based Erms label, this is Earl Wilde's Etude No. 4, setting of George Gershwin's unforgettable tune, Liza.
Thank you.
we got to touch on two more quick areas, and one is kudos to you. You just mentioned how classical pianists have this incredible wealth of repertoire to play. I mean, you wouldn't even have to go past, you know, 1880, and you could very well have a career, as many pianists did. But you won the Gilmour Artist Award. You're a sixth recipient, which recognizes extraordinary piano artistry. And you took that prize money and you turned it around to create even newer repertoire for your instrument. You commissioned Timo Andres and Chick Corea, the Brits Alexander Gore and Alvar Knussen, and the American jazz classical artist Brad Meldow. So I think the Knussen piece, is that the one on the recording, correct? Is that Ophelia's Last Dance?
Yeah, that's on the recording from a couple of years ago.
Right. And I just want to, I don't know if you want to comment on it, but I just want to give you kudos for that. That's incredible that you would turn around and take that money and say, no, I'm going to put it back into expanding the repertoire for this instrument. I think it's great.
Well, thank you very much. And it felt and feels like a good and right, in the best sense of the word, thing to do, because, you know, it's a joy for me to work with living composers and to not be always communicating through the page with, you know, somebody that's 100 years in the grave. And at the same time, I'm not a specialist by any means in modern music, but I think it's very important for all of us to not make such a distinction, and also therefore in programs and the way we present it to audiences. So not that now is a, you know, half a program of modern music, or this is a modern music program, or, you know, and now we don't play modern music, you know, we just have, you know, Mozart and Beethoven and Liszt, but it doesn't really matter. You have a piece that's written 20 years ago, and then you have a piece that's written 200 years ago. And I think if the program is put together with a good sense of narrative, and if the pieces are played with the same kind of commitment that you bring to a Beethoven sonata that supposedly everybody knows, or to a piece that was written 2 years ago, I think then also audiences are not not alarmed, as is so common to think, oh, you know, how are people going to perceive a modern piece. So I think it shouldn't really matter, is this a modern piece or not a modern piece? Is this a good piece, and is this well performed and brought across to the audience? And in that sense, I think therefore we should be, as performers, also contributing to commissioning new pieces and obviously to playing them.
And I assume all these commissions will be coming forward and you'll be recording them and we'll be able to hear them. So that's all good news, right?
Yep, that's definitely the plan.
From my guest Kirill Gerstein's recording on the Mirios Classics label, including music of Schumann and Liszt, here is one of the pieces he commissioned with his award money for the Gilmour Artists Award, this from the noted British composer and conductor Alvar Knussen, called Ophelia's Last Dance. Thank you. The last thing, we probably don't have time to go into Foley, but speaking about, you brought new music to the piano, and then you took one of the cherished war horses for the piano and stood it on its ear. And I'm talking about, of course, the Tchaikovsky Piano Concerto No. 1, where I believe you got contacted from the Tchaikovsky Archive about how the 1879 version, the version Tchaikovsky first put forward, is not what everybody knows, at least for the first few minutes of the concerto. I know there's other patches too, but the most arresting change is those first few chords.
Yeah.
Just a few words about that, because it was a bold thing to do, and it probably needed to be done, and I guess you were the one to do it. So.
Yes, well, that was certainly the idea. And, you know, to put it very simply, when Tchaikovsky wrote the first piano concerto, which is so legendary, in 1875, and incidentally was premiered by a Liszt pupil, Hans von Bülow, in Boston. And then, as often happens with composers, he had the piece on the road for a few years. And then he had very small changes to make in the piano part to make it a bit more practical for the pianist to play. And that became the 1879 version, the one that I recorded, the second and final version by the author himself. And very simply, from 1879 until 1893, the very last public concert when he conducted the premiere of the Pathetic Symphony in the same program in St. Petersburg was also the first piano concerto. And he conducted it in that version, the 1879 version. That's the version that he knew. The new edition of the score that the Tchaikovsky Archive brought out is to a large extent based on Tchaikovsky's own conducting score that's been identified with his own markings, used for that final concert 8 days before. And the version that we have gotten used to hearing was made posthumously, most likely by Alexander Ziloty, a student of his, and it has a number of additions and changes, including the famous bombastic chords of the opening that are actually not what Tchaikovsky wrote. Tchaikovsky wrote something much more lyrical and, I would say, musical instead. So the decision may have seemed radical to some to play it in the 1879 version, but essentially we're going back to what we know Tchaikovsky himself wrote, approved, and conducted. So in that sense, there's a good basic conviction as to why that should be done. And perhaps some of your listeners can hear it also live in New York in February with the New York Philharmonic.
Yeah, well, it's a cleansing that needed to happen. I'm glad you did it. I close all my cadenza interviews by asking my guests two quick questions. You can answer them quickly. The first is hypothetical, which says if you could chat like we've been doing with someone from the past, someone you never had a chance to. What's the first name that pops into your head when I ask that question?
No, I have so many, but I would say maybe Busoni, the great Italian pianist I already mentioned, and Liszt.
Yeah, I think Busoni would be, you're the first one ever in 12 years, by the way, to pick Busoni, but I think it would be a fascinating conversation.
Oh, one of the best, I'm quite sure.
If you would introduce him to jazz, he wouldn't let you go, I don't think. The final question is, everybody interviewing Cadenza fills their life with music. You're very busy, and we're glad you are. When you have to do something non-musical, pleasure, relaxation, enjoyment, what do you do that can take you away when you need to get away?
I love being with people that I love. So I love being with my family and friends. And, you know, and that's usually accompanied by lots of conversation, good food, and lots of wine.
Okay. Well, that will tie into your maybe discussions with Busoni and Liszt as well. Kirill Gerstein, thanks for taking some time.
Thank you for speaking.
Pianist Kirill Gerstein. Okay, so back to that Tchaikovsky and the radical difference in the beginning of the first movement played the way Tchaikovsky knew it and conducted it before the revisions after his death. Just to remind you, here is Van Cliburn banging away at that opening.
Thank you.
So here's my guest, Kirill Gerstein, accompanied by the German Symphony Orchestra Berlin, conducted by James Gaffigan, in the opening of Tchaikovsky's own 1879 version. There you have it, and you can hear the complete concerto with my guest, Kirill Gerstein, a soloist with the New York Philharmonic, conducted by Semyon Bychkov, at David Geffen Hall in New York City tomorrow, a matinee at 11 a.m., Saturday at 8 p.m., and next Thursday at 7:30. For info and tickets, go to nyphil.org. You can find out more about my guest at his website, Kirill Gerstein, K-I-R-I-L-L, Gerstein.com. And I'll leave you with the final movement of the Tchaikovsky Piano Concerto No. 1, once again in the 1879 composer's own version. Once again, the German Symphony Orchestra Berlin is conducted by James Gaffigan, the soloist, my guest today, Kirill Gerstein. As always, I'm glad you are in the audience today, and I hope you'll join me here each week for a chat with the great classical musicians of our area and the globe. Remember, you can catch any recent past Cadenza program by going to wwfm.org and clicking on webcasts. I ask you to please support this and the many specialty programs we offer by making your donation today at our website. Thank you, and thanks for listening. I'm David Ozenberg, and this has been the award-winning Cadenza, an exclusive production of the Classical Network at WWFM.org. Thank you.